You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, computer science-related jobs are the number one source of all new wages in the U.S., but only about half of Wisconsin high schools include it in their curriculum. A Wisconsin high school graduate tells us that needs to change. Now, in less than 15 years, General Motors says it will no longer sell gas-powered cars and trucks. The company announced last week that it will only sell zero-emission vehicles by 2035 and then be carbon neutral by 2040. Other manufacturers, including Ford, Nissan, and Volkswagen, have announced similar goals but on a less ambitious time frame. GM's move comes a week after President Biden signed an executive order reinstating fuel economy standards set during the Obama administration. He also signed a separate order directing the federal government to buy all electric vehicles, and Biden is pushing for other ways to help the electric vehicle industry. On Thursday, White House spokesman Vedant Patel praised GM in a statement saying, quote, "We applaud efforts by the private sector to further embrace renewable and clean energy technologies." He went on to say, as the president and many others have said, efforts like this will help grow our economy and create good-paying union jobs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this move away from gas engines? Do you have an electric vehicle, or would you like to get one? If you're on the fence, what is holding you back from doing it? And if you work at an auto shop, how do you feel about the shift toward electric cars, SUVs, and trucks? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jamie Page Deaton is executive editor of the Best Cars team at U.S. News. Jamie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how lofty is this plan by General Motors to say have no more, internal combustion engines in their vehicles by 2040?
Well, you know, it's not as lofty as it may seem at first glance. If you actually look at the press release that General Motors put out, what they say is, and I'm quoting here, GM aspires to eliminate tailpipe emissions from new light-duty vehicles by 2035. And so there's two key words there. Aspires being the first one. This is kind of like me saying, you know, I aspire to be supermodel thin and a millionaire. It's a great thing to aspire to, but that's not necessarily a goal and it's not necessarily a commitment. So that's one thing that people really need to keep in mind. The other part of this, which I think is key, is this the word of light duty vehicles. Light duty vehicles are those basically passenger vehicles that weigh under 6,000 pounds. Now, the big money makers for GM and really almost all car companies is their trucks. So if you have, you know, a Chevy Silverado that weighs more than 6,000 pounds, it's probably not going to be covered under this plan that GM is putting out there. And those are some of GM's most profitable models, so they're not going to want to mess with that. So how lofty is this goal? I would say it's pretty gosh darn lofty, but let's treat it as, you know, what it is. It's something that they're going to try to do. And really, even if they didn't use such a soft word as aspires, you know, it's not like there's anybody who's going to make them do it. There's not going to be any penalty if they don't make this goal. So it's a good thing that they're going to try and do. But how lofty is it? Well, it's not as lofty as maybe everybody's making it out to be.
How does it compare with comparable statements from other auto manufacturers with longer timelines, it looks like, but are they doing more than aspiring?
Well, I mean, if you look at all of these too, I mean, it's important to really look at and parse the language here. They're doing more than aspiring, but at the same time, they might say that they're going to electrify their lineup or provide more electrified vehicles. That's a key term because within the automotive industry, electrified does not mean just electric. Electrified means has hybrid components or has some electric components. So it could still have a gas engine, and that's something that a lot of them are looking at. Now, what's really, though, pushing these companies to make these pledges and to really focus on them, though, is the wider market and the wider global market for cars. The U.S. market is no longer the largest and most dominant new car market in the world. That's actually China. China accounts for 1/3 of global new car sales and is the largest market currently. And China has announced that they will no longer allow the sale of new gas and diesel cars to be sold there past 2035. So any vehicle that GM wants to sell in China or any car company wants to sell in China is going to need to be either electric or hydrogen fuel cell by 2035. And so it's racing for that slice of the market that's so important to them. And China's not alone in this. Britain Ireland and the Netherlands will also ban the sale of new gas and diesel cars starting in 2030. So this is really, you know, this is a goal that GM has set. You know, it's something they're aspiring to do. And if they don't do it, there's not going to be any sort of legal consequence or anything like that. But the consequence will be they will be shut out of these markets or won't have as many models available in these all important markets for them. So, I mean, this is one, I mean, that's really the main reason why a lot of car companies are now rushing towards this is China is making them.
How about the incentive structure in the U.S.? We had this big push on the under the Obama administration to raise mileage standards, reversed in the Trump administration, returned in the Biden administration. How much is that affecting long-term planning for auto manufacturers?
You know, it really depends on the auto manufacturers. Now, GM is one auto manufacturer who welcomed Trump's changing of the emission standards. And while other auto manufacturers actually stayed with the Obama standards and actually joined in with the state of California and said, we're going to meet the Obama, or I'm sorry, the California standards, which are comparable to the Obama standards. GM said, you know what, we're going to work with the Trump administration and go with their standards. And now that Biden's in, it's understandable if we've got whiplash around this, they're announcing that they all have, you know, that they're planning or aspiring to go all electric by 2035. And so, you know, it's forgivable there's still a lot of environmentalists who are looking at GM and, you know, GM is still kind of in the doghouse with them because GM does have a lineup and a lot of their sales are built on large SUV, large trucks. But it's still, you know, a step in the right direction. And these emission standards, you know, under the Biden administration are going to go forward. And it just really comes down to it's almost less important now what the U.S. does because we are no longer the biggest car market in the world. What really matters is what China does because car manufacturers are realizing that that's where they're going to get the majority of their new sales. They need to build models for that area. And the U.S. is just going to, you know, go along with it. Just like for many years, we were the largest car market in the world. So everybody just kind of followed along with what we did.
Talking to Jamie Page Deaton, executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team, looking at commitments or aspirations from auto manufacturers to go all electric or electrified in the next 15, 20 years. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions on the electric vehicle market. 800-642-1234 is the number. Bruce joins us now in Wautoma. Bruce, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you want to ask about, Bruce?
Well, I got a question. I mean, it's fine and dandy. They want to do all this stuff, but aren't those, you know, I drive big rig and that's what I'm doing right now on my way to Texas. I find it amazing. I see a lot of the electric cars on the road. I see a lot of Teslas and whatnot, but you got everything in your house, everything that goes by semi, you know, they were talking about making a big push to make electric trucks, you know, electric semis. I mean, I don't know what the amount of batteries and aren't those batteries supposed to be the nickel cadmium? I mean, isn't that supposed to be like super toxic?
Bruce, thanks for the call. Jamie, I don't know how much you focus on the big rig side of the market. Do you know anything about electric semis, first of all?
Yeah, that's a big challenge that a lot within, you know, that industry are trying to solve. What it really comes down to is, you know, and the caller's right, these batteries on a large truck, you need a lot of batteries, and that's going to take a long time to charge. And that's really kind of the issue that faces not only, you know, the hauling industry, but also the passenger car industry. It's the question of infrastructure. Now, these longer range trucks are actually farther along in development than I think a lot of people really realize. But what's missing is the ability to charge them when they're on the road. So, I mean, if somebody's driving, you know, taking a big rig from Wisconsin down to Texas, like the caller is, I mean, that's going to, without a place to charge it, it's not going to be able to happen. And it's the same thing too. You know, when you see a lot of Teslas on the interstate, that's because Tesla was very aggressive in launching their own charging infrastructure. And this is something that, you know, President Biden's executive order on climate change actually really delved into building a charging and fast charging network for electric cars, because the development not only needs to come on the battery side, where we need to get batteries that can charge fast or hold more charge and, you know, thus deliver more miles. But the other side of it is we need to be able to charge them. And it's relatively simple. You know, if you're a person who lives in a single family home and you've got a garage, you put a charging station in your garage and it's no big deal. You charge your car like you charge your cell phone every night. But if you're somebody who lives in an apartment or you're taking a long road trip, the infrastructure becomes really key. And that's something that needs to be developed alongside the battery technology and alongside the automotive technology.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about General Motors and other companies making at least tentative commitments to go carbon neutral in the next couple of decades. Jamie Page Deaton is with us, executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about automakers phasing out or at least partially phasing out gas engines? Do you have an electric car? Would you want one? What are the roadblocks for you in doing so? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, take more of your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about electric vehicles and automakers' plans to, or at least aims to, be carbon neutral in the near-ish future. You could join in with your questions or experiences with electric vehicles at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Eric is with us in Duluth. Eric, hi.
Yes. Hello. Good afternoon. So even as I am currently driving my Chevy Volt, I don't trust GM. GM killed the EV1 back in the late 90s, and they killed the Volt as soon as they lost tax credits and just left themselves one EV with nothing in the pipeline, which is obvious. And if you look at what's happening with the Cadillac dealers bailing on GM when they were given the choice, I've got a Tesla on order. I just can't wait for GM any longer.
Eric, thanks for the call. So, JB, Eric's been hurt before by GM, doesn't trust them on this commitment.
Yeah, I mean, GM, you know, and Eric mentioned, you know, the EV1 that GM killed, and then the Volt, which is actually an extended range electric car. I mean, it runs on electricity, but it has a gasoline powered generator for when you're unable to plug in and charge it. But he's incorrect. There are GM electric cars in the pipeline, and that's why GM is feeling a little bit bullish about this. So for one, is the Hummer EV, which is just actually like you would imagine. It's a Hummer, like the old military spec vehicles. It's an electric car. They're bringing back the brand. It's meant to be an off-road monster truck. It has 1,000 horsepower, 1,000 pound-feet of torque. It costs well over $100,000, and they've sold out the first year of production already. And then beyond that, you know, he mentioned that, you know, Cadillac dealers are bailing. Cadillac dealers are bailing on GM because GM is planning on making Cadillac an all-electric brand. And one of the challenges that GM has is dealers, and this is all automakers as well, dealers in general don't like electric cars because dealers make a lot of their money on service visits. And electric cars require less maintenance and less service than gasoline or diesel powered cars do. So it also requires, you know, a lot of, you know, remodeling of your station, new tech, or of your dealership, new techs, new tools. You have to retrain all your staff on how electric cars work. So it's understandable that, you know, a lot of dealers are just rather not investing in this new infrastructure that GM is requiring as Cadillac becomes an all-electric dealer. And this is something that GM has to work on. You know, they really haven't, you know, built a lot of trust with, you know, electric car buyers, and they are really feeling, I think, the heat not only from Tesla but from other up-and-comers like Rivian and Lucid Motors to really bring, you know, the electric car to market and not kill it like they've done in the past. So this is really an open question: is GM going to be able to follow through, or are they going to continue to rely on large trucks and SUVs? And you know, honestly, if GM wants to stay in business again, and if they want access to that Chinese market, they're going to have to follow through. So I know Eric maybe doesn't trust GM, but this time, you know, he's got all of China pushing him to do it. So, you know, this is one where GM probably will have to follow through on it. And so he might not end up being disappointed. But on the other hand, you know, those Teslas really are fun. So I don't begrudge him for buying one.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Ethan now in Chippewa Falls. Ethan, hi.
Hey there. I just got a comment. The energy has to come from somewhere. So is making everything more electric going to put more demand on, say, burning coal to make the electricity?
Ethan, thanks for the call. Yeah, the electric car is agnostic. It doesn't care if the electricity comes from a solar or wind generator or a coal plant or a natural gas plant. What do we know about where the electricity is coming from, Jamie?
Yeah, this is something that's key. You know, they'll say they aspire to be emissions free, you know, only sell emissions free light duty vehicles by 2035. And what they mean is emission free at the tailpipe or, you know, lack thereof. So, you know, Ethan is absolutely right. The electricity has to come from somewhere. However, you know, the electricity that comes, what we've found is that electric cars, even if they're getting their electricity from a coal-fired plant, they're still emitting fewer carbon gases than a gasoline-powered car. And he raises another issue, though. The nation's electrical grid is out of date and already very heavily taxed. So I mentioned, you know, you can just come home if you're charging your car at home. You come home at night, you plug it in like you would your cell phone. Well, what does that mean if everybody's doing that? And this is an issue that California is really looking at because their grid is so overtaxed. California's already had issues, you know, with blackouts, you know, in the past. So this is something that the nation's going to have to look at in terms of upgrading their grid if a lot of electric cars come on it. Now, the nice thing about these electric cars, though, is they tend to come, they tend to be very smart and they tend to be able to talk to the grid. So it's not like your refrigerator that's drawing power all the time. The electric car can, you know, you can come in, you plug it in, you come home, you plug it in. And then the grid's able to say to the car, you know, could you wait a couple hours until you start charging? And so the electric company can kind of roll the charge through all of the cars and, you know, in a given section of the grid. So they're not overwhelmed because most of these electric cars have these smart charging features. So there are some fixes in place already, but definitely the question of infrastructure and the question of where the electricity is coming from are two open ones as EVs tend to, yes, they start to really hit the market.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about electric vehicles with Jamie Page Deaton from U.S. News' Best Cars team. Back to your calls now. Richard is with us in Madison. Richard, hello.
Hi. My comment mainly is it's about time. I've been waiting for the rest of the nation to catch up for quite a long time. I work in the electric bicycle industry right now. I drive an electric car. You covered a lot of the points about being able to time your charge to off-peak hours. But I want you to touch a little bit on other vehicles besides automobiles, too. There's electric bicycles. A lot of your small engine applications like lawnmowers, and I can't wait for a robot snowblower so I could look out the window and watch it blow my driveway.
Useful these days here in Wisconsin. Richard, thanks a lot for the call. So spillover, Richard, is seeing not just in our cars from our development of this technology, Jamie.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, he mentioned electric bicycles. We're also seeing a lot of electric scooters, which are great. You know, I personally, my family, we use an electric lawnmower. It's the best thing ever. You don't have to go to the gas station and drive home with a smelly can of gas just to mow your lawn. And then, you know, other things like snow blowers and leaf blowers. These small engines are so incredibly dirty in the amount of pollution that they release, you know, into the air. And so the more that we can transfer these over, and you'll see, you know, battery technology for things like weed whackers, leaf blowers, all that stuff. You'll see these lawn tools are starting to become more and more useful. Now, that said, you know, my lawnmower, I've got a small lot, so we can run it for about 45 minutes, but then it needs to charge. But that's no big deal because we have a small lawn. But for, you know, other people who have a little bit more space, that's going to be a consideration. I'd also say, too, that, you know, just within the automotive realm, electric cars are so much better than they used to be. You know, if you looked at maybe a Nissan Leaf, you know, back in 2015, you really owe it to yourself to take a look at cars like the Ford Mustang Mach-E, even the Chevy Bolt. Mini has a great Mini Electric. All of these are cars, and even Porsche has a Porsche Taycan, which is basically a four-door electric sedan. All of these EVs are so much better. They no longer drive like golf carts. They no longer feel, you know, cheap and tinny and unsafe and loud. They're actually quite luxurious, quite comfortable. They can work in with your daily life very, very well. And so it's something that, you know, consumers really should take another look at because they're not just, you know, for kind of tree huggers anymore. You know, the Ford Mustang Mach-E is a very, you know, family-friendly, small crossover. It's sporty. And it's just something that, you know, more consumers, don't just limit your shopping as you're looking for a new car. Don't just limit it to gas-only cars. If there's an electric or even plug-in hybrid model there available, take a look at it, because I think you'll be surprised at, you know, the quality and comfort that you find there. Plus, they're really fun to drive because a gasoline engine, you have to wait for it to spool up to have all the torque available to you. And torque is the force that launches a car from a stop. But electric cars, they have all their power available from the instant that you step on the accelerator because they tend to have a lower center of gravity because the batteries are all on the bottom. They handle incredibly well. So even if you're somebody, you know, who's an enthusiast and really likes sporty driving, these are something that you should check out.
In our last minute or so, Jamie, I wanted to ask about another piece of the puzzle from the Biden administration saying, hey, this big customer called the federal government, we're going all electric as soon as we can, but we want U.S.-made and halfway at least union-made cars. Sounds like that's going to be tough to do right now, but does that create an incentive for more automakers to meet that demand here in the U.S.?
Yes, absolutely. Right now, I mean, there are only a couple EVs that are built in the U.S., and they're built by Hyundai in Alabama, where their workforce isn't unionized. So they're only able to get kind of half the cars that the federal government needs. They could also get some, you know, Chevy Bolts, which is Chevy's current electric car. But, you know, at the same time, this is going to be a challenge. I mean, this is a big customer. Of course, not all of the federal government cars are going to, you know, their needs are going to be able to be met by electric cars. I don't think you want, you know, when the FBI is entering a hostage negotiation, you probably don't want them to roll up in a Chevrolet Bolt. You want them to roll up in a big Bearcat. But this is, again, you know, there are all these government forces coming, you know, from overseas, and now more government forces and incentives coming, you know, from the Biden administration to push car companies towards electric cars. And what's really the missing piece here, though, is will consumers adopt them? And that's really, you know, what's going to cause a little bit more of automakers to make that shift. They're going to make more cars available to consumers. And if consumers decide they like them, we get the charging infrastructure in place. Then, you know, you'll see your gas engine go the way of the horse.
Gives us a lot to talk about in future conversations. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jamie Page Deaton is the executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. We talked to her about General Motors' goal to end tailpipe emissions by 2035 and be carbon neutral by 2040. You can still let us know about your own experience with electric cars or interest therein. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up, a Wisconsin high school graduate makes the case for more computer science education in Wisconsin schools. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check in on how Wisconsin's indigenous communities are faring in the pandemic after a spike in cases back in the fall. Now, 90% of parents want their child to study computer science in school, according to surveys, but just 52% of Wisconsin high schools teach that subject. That's according to Code.org, a nonprofit dedicated to advocacy and expansion of computer science programs in K-12 education. Our next guest recently wrote an opinion piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and other papers around the state about Wisconsin's need for more computer science education. Mary Callanan is a rising junior at Yale University majoring in computer science. She's a board member and lead classroom mentor of Code Haven, a student-run organization whose mission is to inclusively increase access to computer science to local middle schoolers. She graduated from Divine Savior Holy Angels High School in Milwaukee. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in that piece you wrote, you shared your own story. When did you first get into computer science and writing code?
Yeah, so during my sophomore year of high school, my high school sent an email that was like, a new Girls Who Code chapter is starting at Marquette University in Milwaukee. And so myself and one other student from DSHA showed up, and it kind of just took off from there. I went to classes every week and just went there for all 3 years after that of high school, and I've just kind of been going ever since.
And you make the case that we need more of that and earlier for kids. Why is that?
Yeah, so I think the most direct answer to that question is that the technology field is rapidly growing. You know, we have new technology introduced every day, and so there's a need for technologists. So the more computer science lessons that are taught to our students, throughout grade school, high school, and then we'll hopefully leave them to college. There's really good job security there. In fact, there's about over 8,000 open computing jobs in Wisconsin every month. And so you really can be sure that you'll find a job. But I think more broadly, if you don't really want to be on a computer every day, computer science classes teach a really valuable lesson in problem solving. You're given a question or a prompt and you have to code and you're kind of faced with like countless errors. So constantly faced with an obstacle and you kind of have to solve that problem on the go and keep solving it until you reach your answer. That's really rewarding and gives you this problem solving and critical thinking skill that you can kind of apply to whatever area you're interested in.
Yeah, that's part of the joy for you, as I understand it, the applied mathematical thinking here, not just sort of the ideas, not just the numbers, but actually taking that mindset and tackling problems with it.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I loved math when I was a kid, but didn't think number theory was for me. So it was fun to be able to apply my love for computers to that problem solving desire.
Tell us what a computer science class at an early level would look like these days. I dimly remember learning how to program in BASIC way back when. I'm guessing it's a little fancier nowadays.
Yeah, so there have been a lot of great tools developed. The main one that sticks out to me is scratch.mit.edu, which is a coding environment that was developed by MIT. And it's kind of drag and drop coding. They have tools for students as young as five to kind of be able to create their own fun little game. With my club Code Haven, we teach our students how to make a maze and they can customize it to be whatever the latest trend is that day. And they really find a lot of joy out of that. And it's just simple drag and drop with them. Escalates into like typing your own code.
And you are interested in getting more computer science education for everybody, but can you talk about the value of making sure it's inclusive and that girls, for example, who might not usually be thought of as the traditional targets of computer science education really need this?
Yeah, definitely. So there are a ton of underrepresented populations in tech that Code Haven, my group, is working towards fixing, and that a lot of Code.org is working on improving that as well. And it's just like any job, you know, you want a lot of viewpoints in there. As AI is becoming more prevalent, you're seeing that the computers kind of adopt biases based on who's programming it. And so it's really good to be able to get everyone's opinion, get everyone's input on what you're producing.
And I know there are some fields in technology, education, and special ed and other things where, you know, there's just not always enough talent to go around to teach these programs. And some school districts have trouble hiring and keeping those teachers. Do we have the talent pool to be teaching computer science in all of our schools at this point?
I definitely think so. I think even if there aren't, like, we don't have teachers who are trained in teaching computer science, there are a ton of good resources. I know there's a Computer Science Teachers Association chapter in Wisconsin here, so there's definitely that website you could go to. My club, and I'm sure there are some here, I know there's one at Marquette, leads a conference where any teacher is welcome from any background, and they can come and learn how to teach their students computer science.
As we wrap up, if people want to check out Code Haven, what kind of things are out there? How can they find you?
Yeah, so we're at codehavenyale.com, and we actually have the conference that I just mentioned coming up, Teach Tech, is what we call it. So you can find info about that on our website. And we're welcoming people from any area. It doesn't just have to be Connecticut, so definitely Wisconsin teachers are welcome to join that as well.
Mary, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Callinan is a rising junior at Yale University, majoring in computer science, board member and lead classroom mentor of the group Code Haven that we've been talking about. She graduated from Divine Savior Holy Angels High School in Milwaukee. She wrote a piece that appeared in a number of Wisconsin papers calling for more computer science education in Wisconsin schools. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Why Wisconsin question about how to cook a particular dish here in the Badger State.
Wisconsin has a lot of official state foods. Cheese is the state dairy product, cranberries are the state fruit, and Kringle is the state pastry. But it doesn't have a state recipe for something like chili with macaroni in it, or does it? Andrea Anderson explains.
Joanna Nelson loves macaroni and chili. Her mom, Joyce Nelson, doesn't.
Okay, you've got the onions here.
They recently made Joyce's chili recipe for lunch at their Wausau home.
Mom, you let me know if I'm doing this right. I know you like to...
Oh, that's perfect.
She kind of showed me how to do this prior, so...
And out of love, Joyce even made some macaroni for her daughter.
Okay, these are about ready to go. And what I'm going to do, since I'm not putting them in the chili because I don't like them in the chili...
But you could, if you do like pasta in your chili, yes. You could add them right in.
Joanna says she's been a fan of macaroni and chili since she had it that way as a teenager.
It wasn't until later in life that I even realized there was this divide. You know, I was a little skeptical at first when I tried it. I think I was at a friend's house. But it was delicious. It just added so much.
But Joyce isn't budging.
When I make chili, it's just chili, no noodles. I think of them as an intruder.
Joanna was so intrigued by the way people eat their chili in Wisconsin that she asked WPR's Wisconsin, is there a right way?
Wisconsin-style chili is a mild chili that has the hamburger, and I use pork. It has usually elbow macaroni, red kidney beans only, as far as I know, tomato juice it's made with, and tomato soup.
Lynn Huntley calls herself a Wisconsin grandma and someone who enjoys food and cooking. She started a food blog called Turnips to Tangerines in 2012 that highlights traditional Wisconsin recipes. Huntley has a collection of more than 300 cookbooks, mostly from Wisconsin churches and service clubs. She says the same basic Wisconsin-style chili recipe is in many of those cookbooks. Huntley says chili is warm and perfect for winter. She and her husband eat a new batch monthly between November and March.
Yeah, it's filling and it makes a big batch so you can feed your family or a crowd.
Chili may be the most versatile recipe there is. And people who promote farm-to-table efforts in Wisconsin are planning the third annual Wisconsin Chili Lunch in February on National Chili Day.
Chili is something that is pretty universal. It's a lot of vegetables and beans and sometimes meat that we cook for a long time, and it's got a lot of flavor. Because it's so flexible, it's a great way to highlight everything that we do in Wisconsin.
Vanessa Harold is farm-to-institution outreach specialist for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Integrated Agriculture Systems. The Wisconsin Chili Lunch has traditionally been aimed at institutions like schools, early child care centers, and hospitals. The last time the event was held, about 50,000 bowls of chili were served.
Traditionally, we would encourage people to do it on the same day, but because of the pandemic, we're welcoming people to participate anytime in February.
Harold says they'd like people to register online for the event to access a lot of Wisconsin chili recipes, with or without macaroni noodles.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story on Wisconsin-style chili, which was produced by WPR's John Davis. The story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the executive director of the Great Lakes Area Tribal Health Board tells us how indigenous communities in Wisconsin are doing during the pandemic. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, is it possible to hack human biology? Companies are selling us the idea that with a little time and maybe a lot of money, we can upgrade the human body. Find out what's going on today at 6 on 1A+. Now, COVID-19 has taken a heavy toll on Wisconsin's Native American communities. Indigenous Wisconsinites have died of COVID-19 at a rate 1.4 times greater than that of white Wisconsinites. Back in October, COVID cases exploded in Native American communities in the state, swelling to 3 times the numbers of the previous month. Numbers have gone down since, as they have in the state at large. Will Funmaker is Executive Director of the Great Lakes Area Tribal Health Board. Will, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, at the national level, January was the deadliest month for COVID-19. Wisconsin numbers as a whole have been getting better over a month. For Native Americans in Wisconsin, what have things looked like lately?
Well, you know, I want to kind of caveat everything initially with just that I'm able to discuss more what I've seen from the Great Lakes Area Tribal Health Board perspective. Many of the tribes are obviously dealing from their different perspective, whether it's in different parts of the country or just in our region here. But overall, there definitely does seem to be a higher rate amongst tribes in our whole region. And that's been a pretty big difficulty because, again, we're kind of looking at harder access to healthcare because of the lower funding. We're also having to deal with regions of that are very hard to access, and persons are dealing with a pandemic where they're not able to get access to healthcare as easily as a lot of persons, whether they're in urban areas or even close areas. I mean, some tribes are hundreds of miles away from the nearest facility to be able to seek any sort of treatment.
And it sounds like that's COVID-19 is creating new problems, but in other ways, it's highlighting already existing problems with healthcare access. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and that's kind of where they're severely underfunded. Indian Health Service, I know they do a lot as best as they're able to, and with the funding that they receive from their government sources. But the Great Lakes region is pretty much generally underfunded very consistently. So when you're behind that eight ball as a Native community with the underfunding, now you throw in a pandemic where you're dealing with, again, what are the comorbidities that make it even more difficult for people, elder people and all those of diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, some of those main areas that are being focused on an underfunded area. And that also ties in with the morbidities of COVID. So that's why we are seeing those communities being severely affected because of those.
Have you seen examples in the Great Lakes region where tribal communities were able to, come up with innovative ways to try to tackle this or deal with other healthcare partners?
Yeah, I know. You know, even when communities are underfunded and Indian Health Service is doing their best with it, the medical personnel that are able to work, that are working, they're doing their absolute best in their communities. These are community members. They're living there generally. They've grown up there, and they're doing their darn best to make sure that they'll be able to provide the care that's needed. So, you know, that's what I've seen working virtually, being able to reach out to those community members as best as they're able to, because, again, a lot of these regions are not necessarily always able to be connecting to Wi-Fi, even getting data on their cell phone. But with some of the real big efforts of the healthcare personnel, of different tribal personnel, they're able to reach out or provide some sort of service, whether it's getting them a data plan of some sort, cell phones, to be able to still continue to connect to other community members. So there has been a lot of effort in that. And again, I can't speak enough about how much the healthcare personnel, even with the disparity in the funding, have really worked hard and diligently to be able to still continue to provide care and to reach out to the community members.
Talking to Will Funmaker, Executive Director of the Great Lakes Area Tribal Health Board, talking about how COVID-19 has affected tribal communities, Native American communities in Wisconsin and in neighboring states, some of the unique challenges they have faced over the last year as well. Well, now, Will, here we are with vaccines rolling out. What are you seeing when it comes to vaccines being distributed to some of your healthcare partners, the people working in these communities around the region?
Yeah, there definitely was a lot of, I know there was some planning help with the Indian Health Service, with some of the states. If we're talking about the state of Wisconsin, there was some various coordination as they were trying to determine where tribes were determining, because they're their own sovereign nation, where they wanted to get their vaccines. So Indian Health Service and the state of Wisconsin was trying to reach out and determine which tribes were going to get it from whom. And some of that communication definitely was getting confused. And being able to determine who was going to be able to get us or get different communities the most amounts and the most efficiently. But communication was getting confused. I think there was a lot of different issues that kind of were coming around with that. I know Indian Health Service was doing their best to coordinate as best that they were able to, the state of Wisconsin as well. I think it seems like it has been getting a little bit more efficient in the recent weeks. I think after the initial opening at the end of December, there was a little bit more of a, definitely, like I said, that confusion. And then as we've gone along, got a little bit more efficient, we have seen a little bit of an uptick in the amounts of vaccines that are able to go out to the different tribes.
Well, I've read about concern among some communities around the United States that you know, this is a disease that, as you mentioned, affects older people particularly hard. Concerns over the loss of elders and what that's going to mean for people who might be actively transmitting, preservation of culture, preservation of language. Is that something you've seen a concern in the Great Lakes area?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's extremely difficult. Obviously, our effect on the effect on of COVID on the elders is high. It's disproportionately high. It's disproportionately high amongst natives. Who is going to be your persons that are fluent speakers? It's going to generally be the older persons. And unfortunately, when they walk on, we lose that information, that things that cannot be, that are very difficult to reproduce. Just the cultural practices, the traditions, that is just that they have locked in that great mind of theirs, and we're not able to recover that. I know many tribes are working to try to document a lot of these things before persons pass on, and it's just a continuing effort. But with this pandemic, obviously everything was shutting down, slowly reopening, but in the meanwhile we're losing hundreds of thousands of persons that are having this knowledge that you're never going to be able to replace. And it's definitely difficult to see. It's continuing, and I know the tribes and around the whole country are doing their darn best to ensure that they're able to protect elders as best as they're able to, whether it's vaccination efforts, getting them health care as best as they can. So it's just a continuing effort, that's for sure.
And Will, in our last minute or so, are there lessons you're hoping we can take as hopefully soon we emerge from COVID-19 when it comes to, you know, ways to have that better healthcare infrastructure in place?
Well, you know, this generally comes down to is funding. When the tribes are able to get funding for their clinics, their healthcare facilities, they're able to provide their healthcare. And there's obviously a lot of hurdles that have to overcome with that. I know that we're, you know, many are hopeful with the new administration that they have voiced support for increased funding. And we're hoping to see something with that because, like we said, natives are behind the eight ball when it came to this pandemic. And when we have that ability to be able to provide that health care in a timely manner, we find that we won't be as lost in the whole shuffle of COVID as, you know, hopefully we're able to meet the standards for that everybody else is seeing.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Will Funmaker is the executive director of the Great Lakes Area Tribal Health Board. He joined us today for a look at the impact of COVID-19 in Native American communities here in Wisconsin. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Kate and her guests look back on the first Black woman to graduate from the UW-Madison Law School, the first Black woman to hold statewide elected office in Wisconsin, and the first Black woman to become a judge in the state. They're all the same person. We'll look at the life and influence of Vel Phillips tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new package of police reform bills has been introduced in the state legislature. We'll talk to the Republican author of those bills about what they could change and why he's optimistic they'll get support from both sides of the aisle. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.